You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Okay, we kick the show off today with a little jingle by our distinguished guest, Corey Cerisi. He said it would be great podcast music when he sent it to me quite some time ago, and I'm inclined to agree. Before we get into it, I want to make a note that this was recorded on Thursday, April 30th. There are currently 1.1 million confirmed cases of the coronavirus in the United States, with 63,538 deaths. We've been sheltering in place for 46 days since we fled Australia. That is 12% of the year 2020. Things are looking good, though. States are starting to open up in phases as far as going to work and school go. I think that with caution and responsibility, we can get back to seeing our loved ones and working on our goddamn lives and moving forward. The future isn't certain, but it is certain that the future is coming. Today's guest is Corey Cerisi. Corey is the owner of Enjoyco, a salon in Portland, Oregon. He's the drummer of AF Records band Lee Corey Oswald, our dear old friends who started with us in Scranton. Now our main focus today, though, in this podcast is discussing his time spent at a now-defunct small boarding school for special needs adolescents in rural upstate New York. It was called the Family Foundation School, also known as the Family School, also known as Allenwood Academy. So the school closed in 2014. They said it was due to money problems from declining enrollment. However, they were plagued with accusations of abuse for many years, and there's reason to believe that this was also why they had closed. The Family School was one of several residential programs for special needs adolescents that were discussed in congressional hearings in 2007 and 2008. You know, they were had surprise inspections, some by many New York agencies, in 2010. In 2018, a front-page article in the New York Times described a pattern of deaths by overdose, suicide, and other misadventure among alumni of the school. One alum tallied 101 such deaths, the vast majority of them being before the age of 40. To let you know ahead of time, we dive into some sensitive subjects, including violence, sexual misconduct, and suicide in this episode. I cannot begin to express the love and friendship I have with Corey. It was not easy for him, and we hope to shine some light on this tragedy as well as make some room for those dealing with trauma. He invites you to reach out to him over at futurefriday.net. I'll also be posting some references and resources regarding some of the things that we discuss in the episode. And without further ado, my friend Corey.
Yes, bro.
All right, here we are. Here I am with Corey. What's up, Corey? Thank you for joining me today.
100%.
It is currently April 30th. I was told myself I was going to read off some of the numbers regarding coronavirus infections and deaths and how many days we've been in quarantine. I'll just add that at the beginning of the show. But yeah, you and I talked about this kind of heavily right before it started happening. I figured we'd get all the coronavirus talk out of the way at the beginning.
Corona what?
Coronavirus. You heard of it?
Yeah. Oh, the thing that has had me out of work since March 11th?
Yeah, that's it. That's that guy right there. All right. So at this part of the podcast, Corey and I spent quite a long time discussing the CARES Act and some of the ways that it applies to both of our technically small businesses. And we hadn't seen each other in a long time, so we spent quite a bit of time catching up. So I decided to take this and add it to the end of the episode so that we can get right into what we came here to kind of talk about. Fucking maniac.
How did we meet?
How did you and I meet? We met at a party.
Okay.
It was a college party for you and a post-high school party for me in Scranton in Westside by the cemetery. Where our mutual friend, leave a nameless, I don't know, for whatever reason, had a party, and we went there, and someone made a joke about drugs or having drugs, and then I made the same joke, and then your roommate came down, sat next to me, and told me you had drugs, and then you came over, and I think I bought a Vicodin from you, and then we hit it off.
Vicodin, yeah.
Yeah. This is like the very beginning of the rumblings of the opioid crisis.
You know, I forgot about that part because the way that I think about it, the first time we actually spent time together was you came to my apartment for Vicodin,
mm-hmm.
and you had a burnt CD that was a rough mix of the very first Menzinger's LP, A Lesson in the Abuse of Information Technology.
Yeah, it wasn't even that LP. It was, I believe, the demo that we had done before that that turned into that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I never fucking listened to it. Is it good?
I mean, at the time, it was good. That's great.
Yeah, I didn't know. I thought maybe you guys were like a ska band or something.
We were. And to clarify, I'm not some kind of like, I'm not a opioid addict or anything like that. You had Vicodin and it was fun once in a while. So that's how.
Yeah, we were young.
Yeah, we were young.
We were young, and every once in a while, you take a Vicodin.
Yeah.
That's how I remember meeting you. And then we lived two blocks from each other. I lived off of Sanderson. Remember my old landlord, Maria? She used to carry a Magnum revolver purse.
Yeah, I do remember
that. And she was like a professional bodybuilder in the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was very, very... She had a lot of energy. But my rent was $200, all-inclusive. I'll never forget that. $200.
That's so cheap.
Yeah. Gosh. Yeah, so when was that? That's, I guess, really what I was asking.
That was probably about 2006. Maybe the middle of 2005.
Yeah. That makes sense, because I graduated college in 2008, and we were already balls deep.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I would put it.
All right.
Yeah, but back to where we're dipping into the family school. That was, because you guys had started... Lee Corey Oswald at that time, or not Lee Corey, there's another Dinosaurs you guys were playing at that time. That's how we met. We played shows together and that. And then, but the real recently we got to talk about the family school was a place that you went to from a very young age. What were you, like 13 when you were sent there?
Correct. I was 13 when I was sent there. Yeah. I think freshly turned 13. But before that, I had been what I guess like people that experience this type of stuff would refer to as like in the system. So whether it's a government institution or privately owned institution. So I was in like a mental health facilities, mental hospital. What is the proper nomenclature these days? Mental
both health sound good to me.
Psych ward, whatever.
I think our generation's a little bit, that was a generation before us may have called it the psych ward.
Okay. So I was in a few of those, and that would be, state-run facility. And then somewhere like the family school is a for-profit private institution. So my family would pay this place money in order to house me and rehabilitate.
And oftentimes something like that is an alternative to a state-run facility that is allowed under the law for you to go there. If, like, let's say the law said you had to go somewhere, you have the choice between going to a state-run facility or you can pay to go to a private institution.
Yes. That wasn't, like, I wasn't involved with that, but lots of my friends there were. So basically, like, you're in trouble with the law. You could either, go to jail, ostensibly, mm-hmm. or... you can go and get rehabilitated at this place. It was like an approved and accredited place.
Yeah.
But it was, for profit, privately run.
Yeah. So you go to this place. It's essentially a summer camp in the woods run by a pseudo religious institution that is for profit, taking money from your parents, taking money, grants from the state.
Yeah. A summer camp that's open all year round.
Yeah. I'm talking about facility wise, like kind of setup wise and schedule wise. Yeah.
But we definitely should paint the image that it's a absolute lockdown facility. Like there's no outside world shit. Like there's money doesn't exist there. Like if they don't want you to have communication with anybody in the outside world, like that's in their control. So summer camp, that's funny. I think about summer camp, which is synonymous with some of the best memories I have in my entire life. And then I think about the family school, which is synonymous with absolutely the worst possible situation I've ever experienced in my whole life.
Yeah, so I definitely don't want to veer into this situation where we're like fetishizing trauma or something like that. Not that we would be, but I think it's important for you to tell the story because of the way that it made me feel about friends and family that had been in similar situations, and the way that it outlined your life and the seeing the things that you had overcome from it. And, you know, it's just a fucking crazy thing that you forget that these exist. And this was only about 20 years ago. Less
sure.
Than, well, I guess 20
less
years
than 20
ago.
Years ago.
Yeah, less than 20 years ago.
It opened in the 80s.
Yeah.
The family school. And then it was shut down, I want to say 2015.
Yeah.
My generation of people who went there were like the generation that got it shut down, because we're, you know, the internet generation. So they were able to form online groups to spread awareness about the abuse of places like this, because the family school is not the only place, you know. There's tons of programs that still exist. Because with minors, the thing that happens when you send a child to a private institution is like your parents sign over complete control, and guardianship falls within the boundaries of this institution that you go to. So they can kind sure. of get away with lots of shit. Like if I had the choice to have gone to jail, there's actually like a lot more regulations and you have a lot more rights there. But when you're a minor, you have no rights. And especially if the guardianship is within like an abusive private run institution, you know?
Yeah. Geographically located, not near anywhere else. There's no like, nobody's visiting, you know, your lawyer's
middle,
not coming. There's no
the
lawyers coming.
Nowhere.
Yeah.
Lawyer. Yeah.
But yeah, so they got you get there. So it's everybody in there is in a similar situation as you. They you know, are struggling with mental health problems. They have to be rehabilitated, or let's say punitive, like a punishment for a crime or whatever it is. And you guys are there, and you get there. What happens when you get there? Like when you rolled in, and everybody ages what, 13 to 18?
Correct. Yeah. Damn, you did your research, my friend. So when you get there, and there are different means of you getting there, which is pretty important, and these still exist. So there's things called escort services, where basically two huge men, always, I'm not generalizing, will come to your house in the middle of the night, 2, 3, 4 a.m.
So this is
sleeping.
Like from The Sopranos. Remember that scene in The Sopranos when they send, what's his face is... Vinny's not Vinny, but the dude they come after his son, and they come in the middle of the night and they put him in handcuffs.
Yep, that's an escort service, and that's exactly that. That's not like that. That's what that was. I forgot about that.
Yeah. I was trying.
Also,
to think
you ever
of a
think
pop
about the character development?
It.
You ever think about his character development? The son, what was his name?
Vito Jr.
Fucking Tony Jr.
No, it was Vito Jr. that got the escort service.
Yeah, Anthony
Jr. I looked
it up
for this because I was trying to find a pop culture reference of
The Sopranos is my favorite show ever.
Damn fine show. It's fucking incredible.
Sopranos changed television forever. But I was thinking about his character development literally the other day, and he gets worse and worse as the seasons go on. He's like the most hateable character on the show, Anthony Jr.
Yeah.
Oh, God, what a little shit.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I mean, yeah. Tony's fault, ass. You know what I mean? Hey. Dad's a murderous scumbag.
Yeah,
treats
like
him that way.
And
kind of morphs his. Yeah, you know.
That's a good point. Anyway, so the options are the escort service, and you know they're supposed to catch you off guard. They put you in handcuffs and they take you away. Because the notion there is if you have any like ideas about you know where you might be being sent to, that you could run away or evade it in some way.
Yeah.
So my parents did, or you know, your parents can take you there. It could be agreed upon. There could be a you know preconceived notion about this happening. My parents did something in between, which was they didn't tell me. They told me that I was going to go tour this school and that they would take me out of like my regular public school for the day, which was exciting that I didn't have to go to school. And just in case things didn't work out, like I could go check out this boarding school. When they took me up there, they failed to mention that this was like a plan was to leave me there. So we go to start a tour and a tour of the facilities, and three men come in and they go, "Hey, your tour starts in the locker room," which was strange. And I get in the locker room and they say, "You are here to stay for a minimum of 18 months. This
Jesus
isn't a tour."
Christ.
And my parents weren't with me. They took me away from them and had me start it in there. And then they proceeded to make me take all my clothes off and my underwear and check that I had nothing on my person. that, you know, drugs or anything like that. But they do it in a very humiliating way. That's kind of like the first thing that they do to start breaking you down and let you know that they're in control. And then they douse you in a de-lysing shampoo over your whole body. And you have to do it in front of them. So they see you doing it on every part of your body to make sure you're not bringing lice into the facilities. And you have to shower in front of them and then get dressed again.
That's fucking crazy. As a 13-year-old.
Yeah, I don't think I ever told you that part,
No, I didn't know that part, no.
Yeah, well, you never asked me what's the first thing that happens. Yeah, wow, I haven't thought about that part in a while. It's like, right off the bat, the first thing they do is just, like, traumatize the shit out of you. While asserting complete dominance, power, and control, you know what I mean?
Of course. I mean, especially when they're that much bigger than you. Like, even when you're that age and a huge man moves really fast, it's scary. You know, I always think about when I was a little kid, like, when a disaster happened or a bunch of adults started running or fist fighting or something, it was always so horrifying because you're just so, like, you know, tiny and frozen and just to be intimidated. Imagine if, like, a fucking 9-foot motherfucker came up to you right now, you know, and with all of the worldly knowledge that you have and, like, the cognitive abilities.
I mean, I still feel that way. I'm 5'6", dude. I still go through life just thinking that everyone wants to assert their dominance over me and that we're in a constant state of, like, emasculating other men, you know?
Little leftover from the tribe.
Yeah, sure.
But, yeah, so you get there. What happens next? You talk to your parents? Like, are they just gone? Do they show you where you're going to sleep? Do you meet
my parents? Left, I think they probably convinced my parents, like, hey, this is the best way, is you just leave and we'll take it from here. I don't know what they tell your parents at that time, but I certainly know that they very, very much lie to your parents for the entire duration of your stay there. And we could get into that later. But basically, whatever time of the day your intake is, you basically just get thrown into, like, the daily livings that happen at the family school from that moment. And I remember that, dude, I want to say it was, like, April 27th, a Wednesday.
So almost, like, a year to the day today.
Oh, my God. I guess so, Tom. Jeez. Yeah. Wow, that fucks me up. Fuck, where were we? I'm sorry.
What happens after that? Like, we just get thrown into the routine. Like, what's the orientation process like?
Got it. So I got thrown into just, like, the normal school day. Because my parents, my intake was just, you know, probably like 2 p.m. on the Wednesday.
Yeah, whenever you got in.
And life there is so different. Can't stop burping. I'm drinking a Polar. Please excuse me. A Polar seltzer water, 100% natural, calorie free.
Delicious.
Anyway.
So you're thrown into a classroom and you have to.
A classroom, right? And you're basically like, you haven't been assigned classes yet. They don't even tell you, like, what grade you're in that. They kind of just, like, figure all of this shit out for you. They just tell you, like, you're in seventh grade. Like, it's so bizarre. So they pair you up with what they call a senior member, which is another student who's been there for an extended period of time, who is working the program. I'm making quotations with my fingers. You can't see.
Sure.
So working the program.
Kind of vocabulary, their nomenclature, working the program. Yeah. Is.
So I'm going to use a lot of the vocabulary that they had there, which is, like, pretty hard to extrapolate.
Sure, you already
used
for some of the phrases that we're familiar with as far as, like, institutional pop culture. You said intake, you know, that's like when you get to a prison, all that kind of shit. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay, so you're with a senior member. To become a senior member, you have to be, you know, working the program. By working the program means following their set of, like, guidelines and ideals in order to be a model citizen in their eyes. Which I would like to say, like, is very, very different than what you and I would think now. And, like, we can definitely break that down and talk about it. But I'm paired up with another student and I'm following that student all day long, morning, afternoon, night, up until bedtime. I have to be within an arm's reach of him at all time. I'm called his shadow.
Okay.
That's like the label that they give you or whatever.
Yeah.
So he's shadowing me. So I'm thrown in. So I'm following him at this point to his classes because I haven't been assigned classes yet and yeah. stuff like that. So that's how it all starts. And then the next thing, I guess, would be the most important part of the day at the family school are meals. So... and more importantly, lunch and dinner, because this is where all of their, and I don't want to say therapizing because it's not therapy. It's like, but it's called a therapeutic boarding school. It's their way of pushing their agenda on the students and like asserting that program into them. And what they do is the whole school is broken down into families, and there's about 35 students per family. There's 8 families, and then there's staff members assigned to each family, right? So there's about 35...
it's like Hogwarts.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Just like that. So every day at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, the whole family assembles, and they get one student at a time up at the, it's called getting them up at the table. So just imagine a bunch of tables arranged in a U shape.
Okay.
And it goes guy, girl, guy, girl, guy, girl. That's the only time a day you're allowed to talk to
the opposite sex.
The opposite sex, correct. Yeah. And at the head of the table are all the staff members. And then there are two very powerful staff members, which are the head of the family, and they're basically act as parents. So okay. ours, it was a husband-wife duo, and the wife was the principal of the school, and the husband was the English teacher. Our family, family one, was like had the notorious, like the most stringent and kind of like the hardest on rules and hardest on student family. That was like what we were known for. Anyway, they would get a student one at a time, get them up, and basically just like drill them, get into like their deepest, darkest secrets.
You mean like make them kind of confess or vocally self-flagellate themselves in front of the everyone else at the U-shaped table, and there's like 35 kids sitting there?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I mean, if, okay, say like I had just gotten sent there, which I did, that's kind of where we're at in the story.
Yeah.
They would get me up and they'd be like, why do you think you were sent here? And I'd be like, obviously, I have no fucking idea why I was sent here. I'm a 13-year-old boy. I mean, I was, you know, I had like a rough go of it. Like, I got into punk rock also at like a really young age. I got real rebellious. I started smoking weed when I was 12. I started like having girlfriends and shit. I didn't like authority. And
you're a difficult to control child behaviorally, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
You're a little asshole.
I was a little shit. I was just a goddamn little shit.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, you know, why did you get here? And then it starts there. And, you know, flash forward, 18-month program. I was left there for 3 years, unfortunately.
Yeah, so just to jump in, to stay with the kind of timeline of the situation, you just get there. You're thrown into it. You have no fucking clue what's going on. And the way that they work is every day they go over their kind of therapeutic method that they call it. So, and this is anchored on lunch and dinner, and you get one person to come up. It's just one per session, and you just kind of come up and just like berate yourself in front of everyone with the adults there.
Like one person up at the table per session. I mean, yeah, it's one person in front of 35 people. Often too, like if you're really, if they deem you like you did something really bad, they'll get you up in front of the entire fucking school.
Jesus.
Yeah, and that was brutal because that's like 250 kids, and that's really humiliating. I mean, basically, it's not just that you're berating yourself, right? It's that basically the techniques that they used were humiliation and embarrassment.
Do you have an example, if you're comfortable, of what kind of things that people would say?
Yeah. Oh, jeez.
That doesn't have to be something that you said or anything like that.
No. I mean, like, I'm trying to figure out
what exactly it would go on. Like, what exactly is this?
Their ideals come from a very, very Christian standpoint. The whole place is based on like very religious ideologies. But let's just say like sex and masturbation and stuff like that. Sexuality.
Okay.
They had this like obsession with not masturbating, and that if a student would to ever masturbate, it would basically block them from throwing themselves into the work of the program. So, like, if they thought that you were ever, like, touching yourself, they would get you up in front of all the other students, guys and girls. And
which is a big fucking deal for a bunch of teenagers. Like, Jesus
Christ. I mean, imagine being 13 years old and having to admit that in front of, like, a bunch of peers your age that, like, you have, like, lusting thoughts and that you fucking masturbate, like, and you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And the whole thing is, if they embarrass you enough, you're not going to want to do it. You're going to have trauma associated with this thing,
yeah,
and you're going to have fear associated with this thing, and then so take that and apply it to, like, literally every other aspect of life, and that's how they're able to break you down, like, essentially using brainwashing techniques, and then build you back up into the person that you want to be. And at that age, like you touched on, it is like you're a sponge, dude.
Yeah,
like, You just absorb whatever's around you. Like, most kids there, they're not learning how to be this like, God-fearing, you know, chase individual. It's like, we are learning by being essentially, like, abused and broken down.
How to avoid another level of Pavlovian, you know, response. It's like, if you don't do this, you don't experience the... it's like shocking a rat, except in a deeply... psychological and arguably spiritual level. Like, that's fucking crazy. So this is how they got everybody to do this during the program. So why would someone get called up? Like, what would you have to do? Or was
for
it just randomly
anything.
Did that?
This is what's
like, you're
wild.
Late
so
for class or some shit? Or did you have that autonomy to walk around where you wanted? Like,
no, you have zero autonomy there. That's a good question. Eventually, like, if you really... which in their eyes, just to touch on this again, like, we're working the program, like, they actually trusted that you know, I have to, if you don't mind me taking a step back, the program is very, very strictly, revolves around Alcoholics Anonymous, and the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Okay.
So everybody that's sent there is deemed some sort of,
Addict or
alcoholic or sex addict or sex. Did I say sex addict? I just did that. Alcoholic, sex addict, drug addict, food addict. Everybody is given a title like that. Very often, multiple titles. Right.
Okay.
So
I never read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a little bit familiar with some of the concepts, and I know some people who have used them to great advantage in their life and for beautiful things. And I know some people who didn't work for it, and I know how it can be interpreted. You know, great ways, and clearly through a kaleidoscope of insanity in this case, in bad ways.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's fucked up. It's like, by the end of my 3 years there, honestly, I was, hi, my name is Corey. I'm a drug addict. I'm an alcoholic. I think at one point I was saying I was a sex addict. I may have said I was a food addict. But, I mean, the rationality is that, you know, before I got sent there, I think I smoked weed a handful of times out of, like, aluminum foil, you know, at Craig's house. Like,
yeah,
fucking,
yeah.
You know what I mean? But the whole thing is just, like, even if you had never done this, there were kids there that were calling themselves alcoholics that had never drank before. Because, basically, they would break you down to the point of where you start thinking to yourself, well, okay, I have addictive tendencies. And the way that I probably would deal with my, like, problems, I'm doing a quotation thing again,
sure,
would be through alcohol, so I might as well preemptively call myself an alcoholic.
Wow.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
So
I mean, that's just
crazy,
so unfair. Yeah, so just like all these titles, right? There's just title after title. So you have this, like, this cornucopia of, like, Alcoholics Anonymous, the Blue Book, the 12 Steps. That's, like, a huge foundation of their program mixed with, and I don't mean spirituality, I mean religion. So when you get there,
this isn't too dissimilar to the structure of some cults, you know, where they
were. It was founded by a cult. I mean, we didn't talk about that.
That's what I mean. That, like, this is just such a precarious and insane situation to find yourself in. Some cults, they'll take a very high personality or set of personalities, people that interpret a religious text or make up their own or their own spirituality or whatever, and the other people fall into that. In this situation, you're sent there as children to be molded, and they used whatever scripture or interpretation that they have of these things to build this system that they try to get everyone to fall into, and it's fucking crazy. What can you touch on a bit about the cult that founded it, you said?
Yeah, so like, I don't want to give any misinformation, but I'm going to do my best. And if part of it is speculation, I apologize. But from what I remember, these people that founded it, it was founded by a man named Tony Argyros. And he was a horrible fucking individual. And I mean, I heard his stories back in the day when it originally opened, and it was a very small group of people. I think that you would go there voluntarily, and it was of all ages, not just teenagers or children. And it was the same techniques, but it was a lot more abusive. There was a lot more physical abuse involved. And they would basically just break you down, have you admit your problems, scream at you. I heard stories of him putting cigarettes out on women when he was Jesus. Angry with them, shit like that.
Yeah.
But these people were very, very closely related to the original people who founded Alcoholics Anonymous and the Big Book and stuff. And basically, from my understanding, during the civil rights days when people were like running away and starting cults in the mountains, you know, mm-hmm. these people started a similar one that was like based all around Alcoholics Anonymous and this type of way of changing people's lives. So it's not like that inherently the people that like work for or created whatever Alcoholics Anonymous are bad people, but these people took it, interpreted it this way and said, this is like our systemic beliefs. And we came up with a program of how we think we can change people, their behavior, and get them to act a different way.
Yeah. Right? I think that's a really important point that you just made, and a really great point that we're not disparaging Alcoholics Anonymous. I've seen it work so beautifully for so many people.
100%.
This is a situation where people took something and ran with it in such a terrible direction and interpretation that it created such a horrible, violent, traumatic, disgusting outcome.
I mean, there's a complete difference in like you saying, hey, I think I might have a problem with alcohol. I'd like to go check out an AA meeting and see if it's something that I'm comfortable with and something that I might align myself with.
Yeah.
Or saying, you're a fucking alcoholic, you child. You are mandated to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting every day of the week. By the way, yeah, you don't have to at first start calling yourself an alcoholic, but after X amount of time, if you don't realize that you are or would be an alcoholic, there's going to be a problem. There's going to be punishments.
Yeah.
And a way to evade that those punishments are just start saying like, I'm Corey, I'm an alcoholic, I'm an addict, I'm a sex addict, I'm a food addict. Yeah, I just have really addictive tendencies. So I need to, you know, figure out how to work this program so I don't receive these punishments. And
that brings a whole new dimension to what you first described at the beginning about what the goal of having the children behave is to, quote unquote, work the program. And that's what you mean is like this organization came up with their own program that they were eventually trying to get you to align yourself with and to internalize, you know, based off of the horrible punishments and humiliating punishments that they gave to you guys.
Yeah, and I'm trying to go and like, so I just like to say in advance, like, forgive me if this bounces all over the place. Like, this place was really, really abusive to everybody that went there, all of my fucking peers that it went there. And a lot of times, like, memories associated with abuse don't really link up with time. It's a different part of your brain. And so my brain kind of jumps all over the place. So I'm doing my best. I just hope it's not like...
No, yeah, no, totally. Okay. Appreciate it immensely. It's painting a picture in that way that you're painting it.
Okay, good. Yeah, there's just a lot to explain because I like none of these things exist anywhere else. I've never heard of them. Like, you and I have talked about this before, but they have these things that are called sanctions. Like, should I talk about that?
Yeah, I think you should. I think that one of the reasons I know that one of the reasons you and I talked about doing this was that people listening can have experiences of their own or may know of things, and that the more that we know about this collectively, the better that we can handle it from the past as it reflects in the present, and the more that we can stop it from happening in the future.
Yeah, or even if like you know somebody that has maybe been through, you know, what we call the system or whatever, like they all come with their own laundry list of like ways that they think and believe that rehabilitating people should work. And a lot of them might not be what you and I like would refer to as healthy.
Sure.
And there's a lot of people that I know that went to like the family school, for instance, like that haven't talked about it.
Yeah.
And have put it down. And like, from any of my experiences there, like, I know how horrible that was. So for somebody to, like, feel like they need to keep that inside and not talk about it, or feel like they're not deserving of help in any sort of way, even if that help is just having a conversation.
Yeah.
I know for me, like, it took me until, like, dude, my 30s to be like, I am a person that experienced trauma, because I see so many other people around me that have experienced traumatic things on any level. And I'm like, well, I quantize it, you know?
Oh, like, of course.
Well,
yeah,
that can't be as bad as what I went through.
Yeah.
Correct.
I don't deserve this.
Like, we should have never talked about this stuff I went through because you were abused as a child, or because this or that, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And it's not fair. We're all deserving of that. So,
oh,
like,
totally. And there's a big difference between, like, somebody who's complaining about their partner that you just met for, like, a fucking hour, which is just annoying, and then someone that has, like, a, you know, like a legitimate experience that they feel that they can't share because of the value or what they deserve to share with it. And I think that's horrible. And it's really, it keeps a lot of beautiful things down in this world.
Yeah,
which really
I think
sucks.
You're right. So I just wanted to say that's, yeah. But they had these, the biggest way that they would, like, kind of, go through with punishments, or with these things called sanctions, right? So basically, the best way to break down somebody is find out what their things that they care about the most, you know, their creative endeavors, their hobbies, and strip them from them so that they can insert, like, the new, like, no, this is your life now. So, you know, I go there and, oh, you're a musician, because I've been playing my whole life just like you, you know? I played drums and shit. So they took music away. So by taking music away, I mean, I can't tap on the table. We had to go to church every day, some sort of church service. Mm-hmm. I'm not allowed to sing hymnals with all the other kids.
Jesus. So for an example, you're in the church, everyone's singing, you know, Here
I'm
I Am, Lord,
to.
Or some shit. You're not allowed to sing.
No, I'm not allowed to sing. And, like,
Jesus Christ.
Whether or not I, like, believe in the sermon or believe in the words, like, having that sort of, like, community where,
yeah,
like,
music.
It's music. You know what it does. And it's shitty. So they take that away from me, you know, because they know that that's something that I care about. So, no, we're going to make you care about something else. So that's a sanction. Also, a lot of sanctions are supposed to be less meaningful as just, like, a punishment to create fear to not do something again. So let's say I failed consistently was failing tests, which means I'm not applying myself well enough, which means, you know, I'm not studying enough, I'm whatever. So they would do things like fuck with your food, because... Man, so, like, okay,
yeah. You get a sanction for failing tests consistently, and it's lunchtime.
So instead of eating whatever everybody else is eating, they're going to give you grade D raw tuna fish on a raw English muffin. Which I don't know if you've seen that kind of tuna fish, but it's not like the gorgeous white tuna mixed with mayonnaise, and it's just like brown chunks of, like, raw tuna fish, and. They eventually did away with that because kids were getting fucking mercury poisoning. And then they switched it over to raw, what were they called? Boca burgers, which was, like,
wow.
A really crappy soy burger.
Yeah, that was, like, the first vegetarian burger that was around.
Yeah, and it's gnarly. It tastes like cardboard. And it would be a raw version of that, so, you know, obviously uncooked, on a raw English muffin. And they give you one juice glass size of water to be able to, like, put a bite in your mouth, mix it with water, and swallow it down. So that would be your punishment. So, like, anything that you did that was, like, deemed unacceptable in their eyes, if they could associate it with, you know, a pain and fear technique, then that would ostensibly change your behavior. And also, like, they put kids in charge of those sanctions. So, like, the senior member that I was describing earlier, you know, who I was shadowing, he'd be in charge of making sure that I had to eat, which they called alternative food, whether that be, you know, the tuna fish or the raw fucking Boca burger.
Yeah.
And kids are vengeful, and kids are kids. And putting children in charge of other children is brutal, especially, like, when they're all being abused. So... they're going to create their own hierarchical
Yeah,
hierarchical?
Their own hierarchical society. System will exist within that. I mean, think of Lord. Yeah. There's a reason why that you read Lord of the Flies. You know, that is. There's a lot of truth to that, and a lot of ourselves reflected in that. Especially if you're a kid and all you see is an adult treating people cruelly, then with cruelty, then you think that that's how to treat somebody, or that's how you get what you want, or that's, you know, your only thing you can control. Plus, kids are just fucking evil already. I mean, think about the times that you were mean to someone for no fucking reason when you were 13.
I mean, kids are. I mean, think of like the bully mentality. It's the same thing. I mean, if a kid is bullied by his father, there's such a large chance he's going to go out and bully other children because A, that's what he knows, and B, that's how he knows how to take out that sort of aggression or whatever. Yeah. So I guess the reason I brought it up is like I have this visual memory of like watching my senior member squeeze all the juice out of the raw tuna fish onto the English muffin.
Wow!
And then putting. Just to make it like that much worse, because that gave him some sort of power, like some sort of, you know, like satisfaction, if you will. It was so gnarly. But I was thinking some of the sanctions the other day because they were just so. There were the ones that were served a purpose, right? And then the ones that were meant to not serve a purpose. So like
arbitrary, I was put to keep you in a type of fear or an
Thank
uncertainty,
you.
Was, a confusion.
Much more eloquent. Thank you, Tom. So there was the one called a work sanction where they would basically take you out of school, right? Which I found out is absolutely illegal. And then they would put you to work, physical labor. And
in
it was especially
capacity,
illegal.
Like doing landscaping at the place, shit like that.
Correct.
Digging
correct.
Ditches.
But one of the biggest things is, yes, digging ditches. Imagine the book Hole. So they wanted to serve you with labor that... didn't yield any sort of like outcome. They didn't want to make you feel like you accomplished anything.
So the epitome of like a busy work situation. Like
correct. Yeah. So like the biggest one that they did would be make us fill up these 40-pound buckets of rocks. They would just have like a pile of rocks and we would fill them with shovels. And then we would walk from one side of a cow field to another side of the cow field, empty it, then fill it back up, walk back to the other side for 8 hours.
That's fucking insane.
And you weren't supposed to feel like you accomplished anything. And I remember, like, I got slammed with sanctions there because I was different. There were a lot of kids that were sent there that were parts of gangs. Like, man, I knew kids that, like, shot other people and stuff.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Real gnarly stuff. But there weren't that many, like, for lack of a better term, like, punks that got sent there. Like, a lot of my rebellious, like, mentality came from, like, punk rock, dude.
Yeah.
And they didn't really know, like, they hadn't seen that too much before, and they didn't really know what to do, and I think that freaked them out, so they just slammed me with sanctions. So I was on tons of work sanctions, and I remember just being, like, elated when I found out, like, oh my god, we're mowing the lawn today? At least, like, we're gonna get something done.
Yeah, at least there's a purpose,
but I mean,
there's an end goal.
Mow a lawn for 8 hours.
Yeah. That's just insane that it's basically like a disciplinary cult.
It's a disciplinary cult. Yeah, and like things like if you walked slowly, right? Like your senior member you could nominate somebody to be brought up at one of those meals.
So this is the kind of shit that creates this lack of trust in the social fabric. Like it almost seems like you can't really unite together in your shared experience when you hear about things like this, when you hear about the doling out of punishments by children to children. Or
totally.
What you're talking about now, which is the kind of backstabbing, you know, like social manipulation and engineering that you could do to get somebody called up in front of one of these things.
Engineering, that's such a great word to describe it. So because there were way less staff members than kids, they basically relied on the kids to police each other, right? So, and you were able to, in a major way, prove your worth in the program, like, by calling out other kids for not doing their work in the program. And you learn this very, very quickly on. You receive more freedom by showing that you believe in the ideologies of the program by slamming other kids who might not be aligning themselves with that. So you can nominate a kid to get up in front of this table and be like, hey, I noticed that you were walking really slowly and you made me late to class because you weren't walking fast enough. So they'd be like, okay, so your sanction's called trotting. Trotting is you're not allowed to walk anywhere without like trotting, like bringing your knees up to your chest.
Jesus.
When you walk anywhere until further notice.
What the fuck is that?
You could be on it for a month, Tom. Like, I'm not making that up. You could only walk from point A to point B by trotting. And it's also supposed to be humiliation. Like, you're trotting like a horse in front of people.
Yeah.
The worst one that they really slammed me with was blackout. And blackout was a term that they used to say that you couldn't talk to a specific person or a specific group of people. So this could apply to other students at the school. It could even apply to staff members, or it could apply to your family. Right. So I would like to say that it's like to have the privilege to even be able to talk to your family. And by family, I mean like hyper specifically your nuclear family.
Parents.
For me, it was only parents. Yeah. Some people had the privilege to talk to their siblings. I was not allowed to, which I found out years later that my brother was writing me letters for all the years I was there. And they threw them all out before they got to me.
Wow.
So I had no idea that my brother was trying to like reach out.
Holy shit.
Yeah, so they would put me on blackout with other students and other families. But I remember I got to the point where I was on blackout with everybody that existed except for my senior member. So there's one person in the entire school that I was allowed to talk to, albeit he was in a different grade than me. So the only time a day that we would see each other is at meals and at night when we were allowed to do our homework. And I was on this for months at a fucking time. So I went probably about 2 months without talking to anybody except for one person. And that was like a punishment.
That's insane. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I'm at a loss for words for a lot of these situations. It really just I can't imagine the weight that is put onto a child in that circumstance. It's fucking crazy.
So you can only imagine, right? Like, say whatever, like bizarre. You could come up with like a insane set of rules and guidelines for how you think the world should be governed. And you say, I want everybody to act like this, and this is the way. This is the only way, right?
Yeah,
and
this is the question that gets to me is there an like, do the people in charge who come up with this, they're creative. I'm sure that they're reading books about psychology and have some kind of bizarre justification for a lot of what they're doing. But, like, you know, are they actually inherently evil? Or do they believe in what they're doing? There has to be a sneaking suspicion inside of them where it's like just taking part in the cruelty themselves. You know, like it's fucking unfathomable to me.
I don't know if they're inherently evil. I don't even know if being evil is an inherent thing. I think that a lot of that kind of shit is learned behavior. And
sure. Yeah, it could be.
Basically, I mean, I truly believe that just the first couple of years of our life alone governs who we're going to be for like the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
I mean that those child attachment styles, you know?
Yeah. I think a lot of the child attachment styles, the systems theories, a lot of the things that at least a lot of me and my friends are starting to learn about as we've gotten older, in our
late
20s and 30s and trying to start to ask the questions, why do we behave the way we do? It does put a whole new twist on the behavior of adults or people that were our age when we were younger and watching them behave. You know, it's kind of that's why I keep coming back to that question of who's in charge here and why. And it's, I don't know, man. It's fucking crazy.
You should write a book called Who's in Charge Here and Why. I would fucking read that on the title alone. But I mean, like my parents, like I disagree with a lot of ways that they raised me from the get-go, you know, and I'm not going to blow up their spot on this podcast, but like some things that I'm very uncomfortable with and very unhappy with that really shaped a lot of the ways, or excuse me, like the things that I don't like about myself, how I behave or how I treat people, and that I've been trying to like unravel and deconstruct and like unlearn, you know, and as you know, as an adult now. And it continued very well into my teenage years while being in the system. So like, you know, maybe you don't like the way that your parents raise you, or maybe you were even abused as a child, you know, send somebody to the family school that's founded by a cult, put them in like a hyper religious and like bizarre ideologies and techniques for executing them, and just basically abuse the shit out of a teenager until they leave.
Yeah.
And it fucked up a lot of fucking people, man. Most of my friends from there are dead. I'm not joking. Like, so, and it's really, that's an really sad.
Powerful point. And to now to say what you're saying now, the after you got out and you've changed your life, clearly you've become a successful business owner, a wonderful, one of my best friends in the entire world. I think you're a wonderful and beautiful human being. What did, as you
Thank
left,
you so
where
much.
What happened to everybody when they left? Now, where do you go from there? What was it like to come back into society? And what and to really bring it home, what have the internet, what role has the internet played in connecting you guys that went there together again?
That's a lot. So
yeah, that's a lot. Sorry. So basically, I was trying to get you to talk about what was like to come back into the world, and then
coming back into the world was also traumatic and really, really difficult. Where are you on the screen? I can't see you.
Oh, I may have disappeared on you. Sorry. I'll try to come back. I think my camera overheated.
Oh, it's okay. That's you just lied to me.
No, I didn't. I think my camera overheated.
What the fuck? No one's ever said that.
Yeah.
Okay. So, my camera overheated.
Yeah, I got I got an external camera thing. Is it back now?
Oh, you have an external camera. No, yeah, you're not back now. It says 30 with a circle around it.
Oh, weird.
Okay. The question was, yeah. When I left there, so I left there under very, very intense and weird means. That was quite different than a lot of other students. There were a lot of students that graduated the program. So by completing the program, not only do you graduate, you know, just the school aspect, because there is school.
It is like a high school still.
It's still a high school.
So
it's all year
round.
You get
your high school diploma from them.
Yeah. From New York State. Yeah. Cause it's in New York. And it's all year round. You get a week off for Christmas and a week off in the summer. So, you have to complete school and you have to complete their program, and they very often don't align, and they're not synonymous, right? So you might be done with all your credits to receive a high school diploma, but if they feel as though you did not complete their program, they're not going to let you graduate. So there was definitely, you know, at any given time, like there's graduations twice a year, and there'd be like upwards of 30 kids that were actually graduated, and there's a whole ceremony. They graduate, they also receive their diploma, and then they move on into the real world. For me, I was not so lucky. I was supposed to graduate, and then after being there for 3 years, mind you, which is double the length of the actual normal program time, and they took my graduation away from me and said, you're going to have to stay here another 6 months. We don't think you're ready to go out into the world. This was all because they let me go on a home visit. Their only way of assimilating you back into society and culture is by very close up to you graduating. They let you go home for a couple days at a time to see your family. But that's it. You can like go places with your family. Like you could go to the movies or you could go to a restaurant or whatever. But you to get that sort of privilege, like you're the creme de la creme.
Yeah, you'd be really working their program.
I mean, I'm there almost 3 years. I finally get this. I get to go home. They failed to remember that they gave me permission to see a childhood best friend. And this person, she like literally was one of the best people I knew, like went to NYU, just like never touched drugs and alcohol in her life. Just a wonderful person. And when I got back, I like told the story of I went on this home visit and I saw her, and they're like, you can't see an old friend. And I was like, you gave me permission. They're like, you know, that's a rule. You can't see an old friend. That's absolutely against the rules. Like you broke the rules, Corey. We're taking your graduation and you're staying another 6 months. And I was like, I cannot be here 3.5 years. Please let me call my parents. And a very, very bizarre thing happened. I went to the principal and I said, please let me call my mom. I have to figure this out. I can't stay here another 6 months. Like I've been here for 3 years. And she said, run away. And I was like,
what the fuck?
Yeah. I was like, what? She was like, run away. I'm giving you the chance right now to run away. I'm giving you a head start before we call the cops or before we send anybody to look at you, look for you. Sorry. And I remember
that's fucking crazy.
I was really, really sick. I had asthmatic bronchitis. I was on a work sanction, because they had already stripped me of all my responsibilities. They stripped me of all my titles, and they put me back to like nothing again, because they found out about this, me seeing this friend on my home visit. And all I had was a pair of sweatpants on and a sweatshirt, and it was raining out, and I was asthmatic bronchitis, and I ran as fast as I could, and I just kept running, and then a car found me, and I put out my thumb, and I was like, can you take me to town? And he was like, are you at that, from that school up the road? And I was like, yeah. And he was just like, okay. And I did what I was actually a really good idea, like, in hindsight. I hitchhiked to a fucking rehab, because I knew that rehab for a minor would be free room and board.
Oh, shit.
And also, like, I was very familiar with the program. A lot of the outpatient AA meetings that we would go to would be at rehabs.
Wow, so it was, I knew, like, that it was a proxy kind of release. Yeah,
I knew it was, like, a safe place, right? So I went there. And then I called... I remember that you could hit 411. Remember that? You could hit 411. Yeah. So I didn't, like, use a phone to call anybody in 3 years. Like, I didn't have any money, anything. And
no calling card? Remember when we used to have calling cards? Yeah.
Jeez. And I remembered you could do 411, and I found out another one of my childhood best friends, I called his house, like his parents' house, and he happened to be home, and he fucking drove up to Binghamton, New York, where this was, and picked me up and brought me home.
Holy shit.
And he was, like, essentially just, like, harboring me, you know, away from my parents or whatever. I was still a minor. I was still 17. And basically I went to my old high school that I would have gone to in Warwick, New York. I went in, and told them, like, the situation, and they were able to get my transcripts, like my actual school transcripts, from the family school, and they fucking gave me a high school diploma. And I apparently had enough. I had enough, because you went to school all year round. I had enough credits to graduate with an advanced Regents diploma, which is like the highest diploma you could get for a high schooler. And I had 3 college classes under my belt already at 17 years old. After my junior year, I didn't need to go to my senior year of high school or whatever. So then I eventually, you know, my parents, I told them, I went home. They kept threatening to send me back to the family school because that's all they knew, you know, was you left this place on bad terms. And we agreed that they would let me go to college. I'd already gotten into college because I was supposed to graduate the family school before they took it away from me. I'd been accepted to Marywood University in Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Catholic college in Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Yep. So I left in the middle of winter, and then I started my college term 2 months later of my freshman year, 2 months after running away from the family school, out of being completely locked out of society, completely, from 13 years old, going straight to college, which was getting back to your original question. So I hope that wasn't too convoluted. I had a point
there.
That
was like a great story. I did not know the details of that story after all these years.
Yeah, it's pretty. I mean, there were obviously
some filler in there.
My parents actually, when they found out I was in out of the family school and had run away, they came and picked me up and brought me back. And it was like couldn't have been. They brought me back, and then the next day I had a meeting with the head staff of the entire school, and my parents even drove up for it. And I basically broke down and was like, I can't be here anymore. Like, I cannot be here anymore. And the family school was just like, the thing is this is why it was so fucked up. And this is why they gave my transcripts to the high school in Warwick, is because they knew that I should have left there. But because I had broke this internal rule that was like a very important rule, they had to take my graduation away.
Yeah, I would imagine that there's not like, as far as New York State goes, a reason for not graduating high school isn't that you saw a friend while you were not in school. You know, you can't.
Exactly.
Yeah, you can. If you skip too many gym classes, they can make you go to, you know, play frisbee after the summer after your senior year. But you can't. Yeah, this is like, as far as their academic accreditation goes, they can't be like, yeah, we didn't give it to him because he this insane, you know, arbitrary disciplinary rule.
Exactly. So I think that's why they let me leave. I think they let me gracefully go without like other students knowing exactly what happened. Let the students think that he ran away when they knew like, okay, he's been here for 3 years. Like maybe he saw an old friend, but like, fuck, you know? And because of that, there was like a pretty decently smooth transition between like them giving my transcripts to another high school, my mom kind of doing her nice, like threatening, like, hey, what you did was illegal. You let my 17-year-old son like run away from your facility. I'll sue you. And cause I was still a minor, you know?
Yeah.
And because of that, 2 months later, so it was really weird going from an absolute 100% lockdown facility. Mind you, for the year to 2 years before that, I was in and out of the system through mental hospitals, in and out patient programs, stuff like that as a child. So I spent like all my teenage years, kind of in the system, if you will.
Yeah.
And then I went to college as a 17-year-old. By 17-year-old, I mean teenager, child. Like,
yeah,
dude, it was insane, you know? So I picked whatever major I thought would be, like, the easiest thing. So what I do, fucking radio and television, which, like, literally the only thing I learned from it is how to make my voice sound okay right now in GarageBand.
Like, well, hopefully we do it service.
Yeah,
hopefully so then after service. College, you get to that. Now, the reconnection with people in the family school comes from, like, a Facebook group situation?
Yeah, the Family Foundation Truth Campaign. That was
okay. So it's called the Family Foundation Truth Campaign.
Yeah, and dude, I want to say the kid that started that killed himself,
Jesus.
Or like a year or two ago, and it may have been an overdose or it may have been an intentional overdose, and that is like pretty ubiquitous amongst the alumni that have passed away since the inception of the family school, which is a staggering amount of alumni. The reason I'm giving that information is you brought up the New York Times article that came out roughly 2 years ago, and it basically, I think, what was it titled? Like who's next or something like that?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Something like who's next?
I'll link to it in the notes at the episode.
You should.
The website.
It's beautiful journalism, and it's really extensive. But it basically refers to my generation of students that went there and how we got it shut down. And their Who's Next is referencing how many alumni have passed since the inception of family school. And it's the amount is unfathomable. I want to say it's like over 118 or something like that. And most of them are either suicide or overdose after coming out of the family school. And these may have been people that used drugs or alcohol before going there as kids, but a lot of them aren't. And I'd really love to suspect that the amount of trauma induced at the family school and the difficulty of processing and navigating that, you know, we're humans and a lot of humans turn to things.
I mean, like, all like empirical, the need for an empirical, you know, matching of the population versus the graduates of the family school thing aside, I would imagine that the outcome is because these fucking kids were forced to live in a high stress, horribly traumatic experience for several years in a cult. I was going to say a pseudo cult, but I mean, essentially, you know, it's a cult. Yeah.
I mean, also like we didn't touch on this, but the kids that did actually like graduate the program and shit, there was no like class or like sort of program in state to assimilate them back into culture before leaving, right?
Yeah, they're gonna be just as fucked up as anybody else.
They throw you completely back into the outside world. And I'm talking like I hadn't even as so much given a girl a high five in 3 years, you know?
Jesus.
Let alone be like, I have a crush on you. Yeah. I hadn't seen money in 3 years.
This is how I talk to you, even though I've never been allowed to talk to you.
Yeah, dude, my first job after leaving the family school, I remember I was working with this gal at a cafe, and we brushed shoulders. And at the family school, if you ever brush shoulders with someone of the opposite sex, you had to acknowledge it and you had to apologize for it. And if you didn't, it was considered flirting and you get in trouble. So I remember Jesus. We brushed shoulders while working in close quarters in a kitchen together. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And she was like, so fucking freaked out. But this is like, literally, like I just got thrown right back in.
Also, yeah, it's like fucking crazy.
Imagine not seeing money for 3 years. And then realize that everything in society runs on money. How do I obtain money? Like, how do I use it?
How do I do it when I have it? Yeah. What is it? Like, how much does something cost?
Yeah. Something else that we really need to touch on and why it closed, because it wasn't just the Family Truth campaign. I mean, that was like a huge reason why it got chosen. I'm super proud of everybody that was involved in that. And that actually, just to go back to the website you were talking about, Family Foundation Truth Campaign, they had tons of alumni submit their testimonials to their experience at the family school, and mine's on there. And that could be a cool link to post too. You can really read, because like, man, some stuff that happened to other people was unbelievable shit. Like, Tom, you and I have talked about it before, things that they did to girls.
Yes.
People that, homosexuals, things that they did to homosexuals, like, well, convince them, that, you
can't
know,
even
that
imagine.
They weren't allowed to be gay. They basically tried to convince them that they had to pray to Jesus Christ to, you know, become straight, because it's, you know, basically evil. And, you know, women, like, it was always about breaking them down. Like, the word slut was used very, very heavily. If you were, like, an attractive girl, and people would express that they would call it lusting, like, it, lustful thoughts, you know? If a lot of guys were having lustful thoughts about
Samantha's fault.
They would punish Samantha, and they would force her to eat more. They would, I forget what the sanction was called, but they could only wear sweatpants and sweatshirts, and then they would cut their hair into a bowl cut.
Jesus Christ. This is the amount of fucking humiliation and control.
I remember, like, this other girl was, she was, you know, sexually active before going to the family school, which is, like, totally fine, you know? Like, a lot of people are sexually active at young ages, and, like...
Well, yeah, you're a teenager. I mean, just being a human being at that age.
Doing it in a healthy manner or whatever, but, yeah, you know, that was what they slammed on her, that she was, like, a sex addict, and they called her a slut, and they told her that if she ever left the family school, that she, trigger warning, sorry, but, like, that she would be raped, maybe murdered. And they made her dig her own grave and get in it. I told you about that.
I think that maybe that would be a good story. It's a terrible story, but I think a something that would really drive the point home of the story is, and then we can wrap it up and talk about how it closed a little bit. I pulled up the article right in front of me.
Yeah.
So they had her go outside with a shovel.
They had to go outside with a shovel and dig a 6x6 foot grave and get in it. And they told her that if she ever left the family school without completing the program, that that's where she would end up.
That's fucking insane. And I know I've beaten that phrase to death here, but that is, I just can't think of another way to put that. You don't realize that happened, especially in our time, you know, to people in our, you weren't from where I was from, but it's close enough, you know, the same situation exists, the same sociodemographics, the same, like, you know, middle class people, lower class people, like, fucking crazy.
One of the things that really served, in my opinion, as the catalyst to shut down the family school outside of the Family Foundation Truth Campaign, is this okay to talk about suicide?
Sure.
Is that okay?
Of course. Yeah. Anything's okay to talk about.
Okay. So we're going to talk about suicide, just saying. There was a kid there who was 15 years old. His name was Tom Milkowski, and I think his name's important, and I always think his name's important. He had three younger sisters, and he had a family. And he was sent to the family school for whatever reason his family deemed he was sent there. And he struggled severely with mental health problems, depression and whatnot, and he reached out to staff and to members of the family school and said that he wanted to kill himself. They told him that he was just being attention seeking, which was a term that was thrown around very heavily at the family school, attention seeking.
Kind of dispel behavior or make it seem
correct.
You're acting out
for some sort of validation, and that's unhealthy and fall back in line.
Validate their feelings.
Anyway, he said, I'm going to kill myself. And they told him to just go to bed and that he was being attention seeking. And the next day he woke up and he plunged from the third story of our building and died. And they tried to cover it up, essentially. And they really did. And no one received any help or therapy. I insert myself here a little bit. I witnessed it. And I was the only one that was there outside. I was on the sidewalk when it happened. And that was something that I still have a lot of trauma from, and a lot of people have a lot of trauma from. Witnessing someone kill themselves fucking sucks. And I feel really bad for him and his sisters and his whole family and everybody else there. But I think that that was one thing where they started, the family school started unraveling, because it did get into the media. And, you know, I witnessed a death and they didn't do one thing to therapize me or help me from that sort of post-traumatic stress, you know, situation.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I mean, I didn't sleep for 2 months. I didn't eat. Every time I closed my eyes, I could just see it happening. For years, I reacted to loud noises, like hearing a loud noise, I would jump. And obviously, like, I mean, flash forward, I mean, I'm 33 now. Maybe I could be around loud noises, but I still have nightmares about it all the time, like all this shit. And it was awful. And they told me, you know, the only help that they offered me was, and offered any other student who may have wanted to reach out about it or didn't. They said that God put us there for a reason, and he killed himself for a reason. And they told me that I witnessed his death because God wanted me to see it. And there was a reason why God had me be there with him in his last moments. And that was all they offered me for this horribly traumatic experience. So couple that with the Family Foundation Truth Campaign, who began to expose all these things, because our families didn't know what was happening there. You know, when I finally had the privilege to talk to my parents, finally, I think it was like after 2 years or something, and it was a 5-minute phone conversation once a week, and there was another staff member on the line, and that's how you could have a conversation with your parents. So if you said anything contrary to the beliefs, ideals, system of the family school, they would hang up the phone. So my parents had no idea that any of this stuff was going on. And a lot of our folks didn't believe us when we came out and tried to like expose all this. And I don't blame them, because it's unbelievable. B, for them to like have to be accountable, knowing that they drain their bank accounts to send us to a place thinking that their children were going to get rehabilitated, and instead they were just abused horribly, is a really, really hard pill to swallow. On top of it, the Family Foundation School cost $68,000 a year. So my parents spent all of their savings to put me through a place that, in a way, and I don't mean to sound like this is hyperbole, but kind of ruined my life.
Yeah.
So the guilt that my parents probably have
to frame that.
Sure. Like, I don't hate my parents for a lot of people. That's always like their first fucking question for some reason, is like, oh, so you hate your parents for sending you away. And I'm like, I don't. Maybe if they knew of the abuse that was happening when it happened, like, yeah, sure. But I forgive them for it, and I know that it's probably traumatic for them in their own way. Like, yeah they didn't.
I think it's extremely a big, for the simplest way to put it, it's very big of you to immediately forgive them and not immediately, but now you forgive them. Now you process that. Now you love them and understand where they were coming from and frame it that way. And I'm terribly sorry. You told me that story about what was his name again?
The kid that
Tom Milkowski. You told me that story before, and I'm terribly sorry that you had to experience that, and that the other kids there had to go through that, that his family had to experience that. And I think it's a very powerful thing that you shared that story. And
thanks, I appreciate that. I was 16 when that happened. It sucks. Like, when I remember, I didn't read that article by myself. I remember when it came out, I had to read it with somebody else because I didn't know what feelings and emotions that it was going to elicit.
Yeah.
And I knew that it was going to be intense. And I think it was really a really, really good article. Obviously, there's going to be a sensational aspect, and there's going to be a lot of, it's dramatic.
Yeah. And you're a up close in front player in the story. Yeah. So it's going to be,
I didn't know what it was going to be about.
It's going to be
what?
Different than anything is going to be. And, you know, there's a lot of times we dichotomize things and make sides to things, but I mean, you know, this is an account of an event and, or of an institution, many events over a long time.
Yeah. Once I read that article, I'm sorry to cut you off, dude.
No,
Once I read that article, that's when I really realized, like, dude, if I need to talk about this more, people need to know about this more. This shit still exists. Just because the family school doesn't exist doesn't mean that there aren't, like, countless programs and institutions that still do horrible shit.
Yeah.
But reading that article was nuts. I had no idea. I mean, I know a lot of my friends are past, but I had no idea actually how many kids had chosen to take their own lives.
Yeah, it says here, just reading right off their Wikipedia page, for closing, on July 31st, 2014, citing financial challenges from declining enrollment, the school announced it would be closing its doors after 8 days of that day. Weird way to word it. In addition to financial challenges, it has been suggested that lingering accusations of abuse by school staff members that plagued the school for years played a role in the school's declining enrollment and eventual closure. A front-page New York Times article in 2018 described a pattern of deaths by overdose, suicide, and other misadventure among school alumni and said that one alumna had tallied 101 deaths, the vast majority being before the age of 40.
Jeez. Well, there you go. Let that soak in.
That's so incredibly unfortunate, powerful, and you know, insane. I can't fucking believe that this happened so recently. And it only closed 6 years ago.
Isn't that wild? And I forgot that the way that they chose to deal with it was they didn't tell the kids that they were closing. And I guess that makes sense. If they chose to tell the remaining students that they were closing, it probably would have been a fucking free-for-all or some sort of uprising.
Yeah, well, it says they made the announcement 8 days before they were going to close, but that they remained open for 15 kids through the end of 2014.
Yeah, that was probably... Dude, there were times where... A lot of times where kids turned 18, in which case they weren't a minor anymore, and they still chose to stay there. Like,
yeah,
the amount
if you didn't
of
have anywhere else to go, the only thing you knew was that your quote-unquote real your family, you know? Even just using that terminology and the way that they structured themselves is creepy. You know, man, it's fucking weird as hell.
Yeah.
But I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been an hour and a half. We fucking crushed
really?
It. Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Thanks so much for sharing this. I'm going to put the article in the show notes, and anything else that you felt would be important to add, I'm going to put in the show notes, as well as some resources for anybody who has experienced this kind of trauma in their life or know someone that has, and some places that they can reach out for help. I think that
I mean, I would love to make my information readily available to anybody if any of this resonates with them. I'm so happy to talk to anybody.
Yeah, we'll figure out a way to put your contact information, whatever information you're comfortable with, we'll put right on the show notes there as well if someone wants to
reach
out.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to me about this stuff. I love you very much.
Yeah, I love you so much, my friend. And how about this? The next one that we do is going to be fun.
Yeah. We could talk about the time where I learned to juggle.
Yeah, we're going to go over, we're going to make a list of the things and we'll just line them up. We'll talk about the time that the cops came to your house and it was the first time we ever tried the, if we don't let them in, they'll have to leave.
And it worked. We hid in the crawl
space. We
turned
all the lights off and just laid on the floor and the cops just kept banging on the door for like 25 minutes and eventually gave up and left.
Oh my God, it does work.
Yeah, no, totally. What are they going to do, kick the door down?
If you're black.
I mean, yeah, or now too, you know, maybe it's a little different these times. This was many years ago.
Wow. All right, dude. Well, thank you so much for your time and energy.
Hell yeah.
Excited.
Man. Love you, Dad. I'll talk to you next time.
All right. Take care, my friend.
Bye bye. Man, that was a doozy. Thank you so much, Corey, for doing that. Thank you so much for listening. We've got some potentially very cool news, very big news coming up for the podcast that is potentially something going on in the works that I can't talk about now, but would be absolutely fantastic. I want to thank Corey Cerisi for the pre-intro and Queen Jesus for the intro and for Beth Ann Downey for producing this. I don't know what that noise was, but I'm just going to leave it in there. And we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
If you want to talk about the economic impact on small businesses, I could spend an hour if you'd like.
Yeah, if anybody, so people like you who are a barber, I own a barbershop, and a musician who gets paid from live shows. Clearly, both of us are unable to work right now. And we don't necessarily fall into the category of someone that can apply for unemployment. Although the rules from the CARES Act has changed that a little bit. Small business owners are able to apply for unemployment under something called the PUA. But we were in line to get something called the PPP, which is the Paycheck Protection Act, which has not worked out thus far for either of us. But we'll see. We'll see how it goes, at least for us.
Not true, Tom, eh?
You got the PPP?
At 10 p.m. last night, I got an email saying that I was approved for the PPP loan, and I was approved by my lender and by the SBA, and to sit tight to wait for the next steps.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that we might be in a similar situation. I applied on April 12th, maybe like 18 days ago, and then they ran out of money. And basically, what the application for is essentially 8 weeks of the average payroll costs, which is basically just what you pay yourself and your employees, of 2019. So yeah, we went through that application process, and the PPP ran out of money, and then Congress emergency funded it again. And now we're just waiting to hear back and waiting for the SBA to send the money through. So hopefully that works for us. But it's been a complete clusterfuck to try to figure out how to do that.
I'd like to say that I have a CPA, I have a lawyer, and I have a business manager. And the one person that was able to beautifully figure out how I should and could fill out the PPP loan application was Tom May.
Thank you. Yeah, that was and that was only also, because I worked so closely. Shout out to Chris Ruggiero, our band's accountant, and our manager, Tim Zahotsky. There was kind of a network of musicians and small business owners emailing each other trying to sort through all of that when it first came out. Because when they funded it, when they put it out, everybody was like, what do we do?
Yeah, it was really difficult, like, because I had so many conversations with so many people who are way smarter than me with numbers and financials, and it was just a nightmare because the the type of business that I own is, you know, immersed in the gig economy, and like the PPP is, you know, paycheck protection. So like, it's basically what's my paycheck as a business owner, but I'm not an S corp. I'm not like on payroll. I basically like take disbursements, and that shit like fluctuates because I own a salon, you know, and it's like I have people working for me, but they're not employees, they're independent contractors. So like, it was so convoluted to get to like the nitty gritty, to get actually what details do they need in order for me to not get denied. And I'd like to also say something about the pandemic unemployment assistance. I actually am in a like beta pilot program for it. I forgot to tell you both of these things, and I'm sorry because you've been like working so closely with me.
Sure, I know a lot of people who are listening have some of the same questions.
Okay, good. Well, yeah, then I think this is helpful. And I have my gripes with this too. So actually 2 weeks ago, I think they unrolled the PUA yesterday in Oregon, but 2 weeks ago I was asked to be in like this beta trial for it, which they ostensibly just like send me the application without any information. And I think it's to like see how will somebody go about filling this out? You know, like how easy or not easy is this? And also like, how are we
beta testing the unemployment process for gig workers?
Which is fucked up.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I mean, at least they're doing something.
Yeah, but yesterday when they released it to the public, they released it with like a beautiful tutorial of how to fill out the application, and it took me 2.5 hours to fill out this application. I was surrounded by three people, the people I've been sheltered in with, and I called my partner's dad. So there was basically five of us trying to figure out this application because the verbiage was off the wall. And then yesterday they released it with a tutorial of how to answer every question, and I was so frustrated, and I realized that I answered three questions completely wrong. So now I'm scared that I'm going to be denied because of my answers.
Yeah. It's messy. It's a giant fucking clusterfuck. So back to the fact that you do this salon, that's a very close proximity, person to person service, essentially, to frame it that way. So what do you see the future of that going forward in regards to how you're going to manage it? We've seen photographs of people in Atlanta and how they've done it. People are outside of a barbershop in line to get their haircut. You know, they're people doing the haircutting. Personal protection equipment on, that it's just kind of a bizarre and intense situation to be in.
Geez, I wish I didn't smoke pot, man. You're going to give me a panic attack right now.
That's just fine. Not to get a panic attack, but just fine that you feel, you know.
Well, I don't know. I'm taking it a day at a time. Honestly, my full-time job has been trying to, like, just locate money, how to, like, not speaking in hyperbole, like, save my business.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's this, like, sort of alliance going on right now between a handful of states coming up with a plan of, like, when and how businesses will be able to open.
Sure.
And the only state that's really released that information is California. But this, like, alliance, I think it includes, like, California,
West Coast,
Oregon,
yeah.
Washington.
Pennsylvania has a rollout plan that is tied to the federal government's guidelines that you know, seems to be is similar, not dissimilar to California's or to a lot of the other states. So it is, there's a lot of hope coming forward in the future. And by the time this comes out, which is probably going to be tomorrow, not much will have changed, but we are seemingly on the precipice of returning to a little bit of a semblance of normalcy from this entire shelter
well,
in place.
Well, in reference to my salon, what California released yesterday is salons will be part of phase 3 of this rollout.
Yeah.
And which they said is a few months from now. So I have been out of work since March 11th, and a few months from now could put us July or later.
Yeah.
The PPP loan is only to cover 8 weeks of the money that I missed, which as 8 weeks has already come and gone. Still haven't been approved or denied, I guess, for this unemployment. Haven't received my stimulus, anything. So the reason I brought up that is if it's anything like what California is saying and the salons are part of phase 3, that's not going to be for months from now. And I don't know what it's going to be like. If I imagine it's going to be part of what it was when we were open previously about having 10 or less people in there. But I imagine the guidelines will be pretty intense. Like, we're probably going to have to wear a mask and maybe even one of those like plastic masks, if you will, in front of it.
Sure.
Probably gloves.
Like a mortician.
Like a mortician.
Yeah.
Jesus. but I think a lot of businesses and different like careers and jobs or whatever are going to be different going forward. The restaurant industry is going to be completely different.
Yeah, I think you could take people in your situation and my situation and multiply that by millions and you see what you have here. I mean, it's fucking crazy. I know that some of the biggest promoters in the country are currently not buying shows, which means that you can't book any shows that aren't booked already up into, you know, some of them are indefinite. Some of them are, there's rumors that the companies are just going to not be around anymore after this.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's pretty fucking crazy and it's going to change.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, sure. I think that things are going to change permanently and we don't know how it's going to go forward, but I think that we do have at least the people that, like you saying, you're talking to other salon owners, and we obviously are talking to lots of other musicians, and it is, it's very uncertain, but there is a network in place for us to kind of try to do something together to make it happen, you know? It does funny that we both work in the thing that's like the end-all be-all, you know? Like, my job is to bring hundreds, if not thousands, of people together in a small space where we can sweat and cough on each other. But we'll see. Who knows? I mean, there could be a development of vaccine, and there may be an approach similar to some of the, like, you know, to like Sweden, for example, where they are sheltering and quarantining those that are very at risk and kind of letting everybody else get immunity from being exposed and getting sick, you know. So who knows, like, what?
Yeah, but these are Americans, dude. Once you start being like, okay, well, you people can go out and you people can't go out, you're considered at risk, which is also, like, by the way, our decision, not your decision. Like, there's gonna, are you kidding me? This is America. There's no fucking way that's gonna happen. Dude, I don't mean to sound so doom and gloom, but I mean, your part of the gig economy is going to be like the last phase of rollout because you're bringing such a large amount of people into smaller spaces and like...
Yeah, it's kind of the worst thing to be in. Besides anybody who's on, you know, has to deal with all the people that are becoming infected or has to deal with any type of increases of crime or has been completely impoverished. I have no fucking idea when and if we're going to be able to go back to work in the same way. But
yeah,
you know, we'll make it. We'll make something work.
Yeah, I mean, at least for
we'll
me,
just
like
have
I
really small shows with really rich people.
Wow!
Right, like Bob Dylan did Fugazi, all those years ago.
The Fugazi, like $5 show thing at just like tiny at anarchist bookstores.
Yeah, everyone's at anarchist bookstores, but the tickets are $400 or $500 each.
Oh my god, that's amazing!
Yeah, maybe we'll turn to sponsorship. We can get fucking Casper to put an ad over one of my amps.
Dude, I really do like just to spin it a little bit positively. Mm-hmm. I think in a lot of different career paths and creative endeavors, the amount that people are offering free content or education, things like that. Like I'm noticing in my industry, online education, things in my industry, education is extremely expensive from the get-go. I mean, I took a three-day course that cost $3,000 just to learn, you know, a couple fucking haircuts. But a lot of online courses could be like $800 just to have access to an archive of like haircutting tutorials.
Yeah.
And it's
on top
all
of
free
that, don't
right
you?
Now.
A lot of places I know, Oregon has it, and a lot of other states and localities will have like a kind of a more than necessary rigorous certification process to be able to cut hair. God. They always bring up the point, like, you know, you got girls in North Philly trying to start a hair braiding business or something, and they can't because they need to get, you know, they need to drop a lot of money to be able to get a certification to do so. I could be completely fucking wrong about the Philadelphia aspect.
No, you're very right. They actually take it very seriously out here. Yeah. So,
and I guess it makes sense for sanitation-wise, but it also is like, really? Like, you can't, how are you supposed to get your shit started if you need fucking $5,000 to be able to take a class?
Well, they take it very seriously out here because they basically, like, refer to skin diseases and disorders and cleanliness, disinfecting, stuff like that. So like in school, like we're forced to go to school and we're supposed to learn about infectious diseases. Cause basically, I mean, the tools that we're using, like it's very easy to spread illness.
Sure.
And that's why I think like going forward, even like my industry is going to be so different. But Oregon is a state that takes things like that very seriously. Like for tattooing, for instance, like you have to go to tattooing school here. You cannot be an apprentice and then work. Same with barbering. Like there's a lot of states. It might be this way in PA. I know it is in New Jersey, California. Instead of going to beauty school, you can apprentice, learn in the field, and then get a license. But here, like you have to put the hours in. You have to go through a rigorous course. I mean, I have a bachelor's degree. I swear to God, beauty school is harder. And I went after college. And it's like also $18,000 to go to barber
insane.
School. It's like,
yeah,
it's insane.
I mean, I'm not trying to take away from the level of skill and preparation and practice that goes into barbering and, cosmetology or whatever, but I mean, $18,000 seems a little inaccessible for a lot of people, which fucking sucks.
I mean, I was just paying my teachers off and shit. I hate school. I would go to Starbucks and I would like, basically, you know how I am. I'd like flirt with my teachers, get real friendly with them, and then I'd find out what they like to drink coffee-wise. And then before I came in, I'd go pick up, you know, like a latte and like a frappuccino and shit, and I'd bring it. And then they'd just be like signing off my hours. I got out of beauty school in 4 months instead of a year.
Incredible. I also was part of, which one did you give me? You gave me a facial, right? That was what you needed as part of your test. So I came in while we were on tour.
Can you please put that into context?
Yes. Yeah, Corey gave me a facial. That'll be like the Instagram poll quote part of it.
Member of Menzingers receives facial from...
Oh, man. It's like we're back when we met like 20 years ago when we had that. That was our sense of humor.
God damn. A facial, by the way, is a very relaxing service which there are manipulations to the face involving, you know, creams and toners and like massaging and stuff. That's what a facial is in my industry.
Yeah, it was cool. I mean, I felt very exfoliated and really nice after, really fresh afterwards. It's nice.
The fuck do you know about exfoliation?
I know that I have to do it because I get a rash on my beard. So I use like little apricot scrubs. You know, those little bubbles that might be like killing fish or whatever. I don't care.
Well, like St. Ives apricot scrub?
Yeah, but I like the one with the coconuts in it, too.
Shit's garbage.
Yeah. I Fair enough. No, actually, I get a different pad. One from a homemade place in Queen in down in the neighborhood in Philly, but we'll talk about that.
Go in your kitchen, grab a Brillo pad and some olive oil, and go to town on your fucking face.
That's what I should do. That really is what I should do. But yeah, so that is completely changing. But to loop back to your point about education right now, there is tons of really cool free education that's going on online right now. You can go to Coursera.org, which is one that I've talked about on the podcast before. That's where I got my 5-class certificate program of photography through Michigan State, a partnership with Michigan State University and Coursera. And right now I'm doing one that is a partnership with Berklee School of Music, and it is a music production certificate program. There's 4 classes. One's about the kind of the fundamentals of music production, like recording at home kind of situation. And you know, I've been doing this for a really long time, so I knew a lot of that, but it's really filling in a lot of information gaps that I didn't even realize existed. Another class is on Ableton Live, which, Jesus Christ, I wish I started learning Ableton Live like 10 years ago and used it in songwriting. It's so fucking cool. And then there's
What's the difference between Ableton and Ableton Live?
Ableton Live is Ableton. That's their name of their DAW. Yeah, it's a non-linear DAW. So basically, when you're working in Pro Tools and Logic and GarageBand and all that shit, you're kind of building the song from the left to the right. There's a timeline that exists. You're
watching it happen.
Tracks going. Yeah, we're both watching it happen right now. And Ableton is a non-linear DAW, so you build the parts. You might like build a verse, or you might build like a loop or some shit that you want to put into it, and then you arrange it kind of like how you did in Fruity Loops. It's like a super, super fucking cool, super easy to write with. I fucking love it, man. But yeah, and so many of these companies are offering, like, I know Adobe is doing their Creative Suite free for a month, I believe. And Adobe Live is doing their, there's like a workaround to get it.
Wait, let me ask you a question too.
Sure.
When you said you got that photography certification,
mm-hmm.
what does that entail? And I didn't know that photographers get certifications.
Yeah, so it's kind of I don't want to say arbitrary, the certification part of it, but it's you know, it is an institution that gives you a certificate. It's not accredited in the same way that a university would be accredited, but it is like something that if you wanted to, you can add to your professional portfolio. Like, or to me, I'm going to print it out and put it on the wall. I can't fucking wait.
But, accolades.
Accolades. Yeah, your accolades. It's like winning when you kill, when you get 20 headshots in a video game and you get like the dead alien skull. This is the equivalement of that. From back when I used to play Halo. But yeah, the photography one was, you know, it taught the kind of fundamentals of photography from an artistic standpoint and a mechanical standpoint. And yeah, it was incredible. I can't shout out those professors enough. That program changed my life, changed the way that I look at the world, changed the vocabulary I use when I describe things, changed the way that I write music. It's super fucking cool.
You're gonna have to send me that, dude, because I've been real into my camera lately. It's super.
Yeah,
fun.
I'm gonna put that shit up on the show notes of this webpage. So
you like some of my pictures? I
do. I love some of your pictures. Most of them.
Thank
all
you.
Of them. I like that. So yeah, we originally got the idea to talk on this podcast to talk about your experiences. Well, first of all, Lee Corey Oswald is the one of the big connections that a lot of the fans of the podcast and my band will know you from. But you and I have been friends for a very long time. And I think that sometimes it's kind of difficult to borrow from another podcast I was listening to. It's hard for when two friends are doing it to not just sound like two friends conversing, which is fun because, you know, we're fun, hilarious, interesting people. But just wanted to wrap it into like frame the whole thing with your experience at something called the Family School, which a lot of people probably have not heard of. It is a juvenile detention. Not necessarily a detention center in the conventional sense, but more of like a behavioral camp with a religious funding to it. And
yeah,
I thought
that.
We could talk. Yeah, it came into – there was an article about it in the New York Times. I think it was 2 years ago. And a network of people came together using Facebook to try to find alumni of the school. And that was when, you know, you kind of started to make another connection back to it. And I thought we could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I'd like to say that when we previously recorded a version of this podcast just to talk about life in general, and we ended up landing on the Family School for so long that we realized we should like re-record this and kind of focus on this because it's really intense and there's a lot of information that potentially could be helpful to people, even if it's just bringing awareness, but even down to like, you know, talking about trauma and mental health and how things like this could shape the individual that we are today, and kind of shedding light on that. And
exactly.
I
wanted to show the hopefulness of how you've taken that experience, worked through your life, and now, you know, have started a business where you help other people work and you cut people's hair and help them feel good about themselves and kind of like create a network within itself. Even though,
boy, do I miss that.
The virus has other plans.
But the virus has other plans. Did you see that Donald Trump said that he's thinking that China created coronavirus as a conspiracy for him to lose the election?
Interesting. I haven't been watching the things he's been saying for quite a time now.
Good.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hey, this is Dewey Halpas, host of Peer Pleasure on the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Join me each week as I explore another long-form conversation with one of your favorite musicians, actors, comedians, or creatives. From Chino Moreno of the Deftones, John Gorley of Portugal the Man, to Fat Mike from NoFX and Ian MacKay from Fugazi and Minor Threat, we go all over the map. From Fall Out Boy to Slayer, Peer Pleasure has it all. Check us out now on Sound Talent Media.